Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Laura Seidel, NPR correspondent, and your moderator for today. We also welcome our listeners at home and invite everyone to visit us at commonwealthclub.org. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Namat Hafez Baranji. Baranji received her PhD from Cornell University, where the focus of her studies was the role of women in Islam. She's currently a research fellow in the Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies program at Cornell. At a moment when the image of Islam we see is of veiled, oppressed women, Dr. Baranji looks to the Quran for a different vision of women in Islam. In her new book, Women's Identity and the Quran, she argues that there could be a peaceful revolution where if women were equally involved in the interpretation of the Quran. So without further ado, Dr. Baranji.
Good afternoon. And assalamu alaikum. With the greetings of Islam, may peace be upon you. I would like to thank the organizer, especially Cecilia and Laura, for moderating this afternoon session. I would also like to thank you, the members of the Commonwealth, and the organizers who selected this very sensitive topic and asked me to speak about it. And last but not least, I thank you all for coming, and some of you have to drive quite a distance to be here this afternoon. And I look forward to our dialogue after my conversation, my presentation. I assume all of you have seen the handout, so you are familiar with some of the terms that I will be using. So often I like to speak while standing. It gives me more power to project my voice. So if you don't mind, I'll be speaking while standing. Can everybody hear me well? Thank you. The time has come for Muslim women to move from the peaceful, silent revolution that is firmly grounded in the Quran into an open struggle against injustice. I chose this topic because there is a crisis in understanding Islam vis-a-vis Muslims from the Far East to the far west. As a result of this crisis, the majority of Muslim women have lost their identity and identification with Islam. The core problem within the current globalization of democracy movement is the absence of Muslim women in shaping and developing Islamic thought. That is the pathetic conditions for the majority of the 700 million Muslim women require a change in perception, attitude, and on the ground. As stated in the chapter 13 of the Quran, that says, God will not change what is with people until they change what is in themselves. Thus, women must reinterpret the Quran to change the understanding of Muslim women and Islam that may eventually transform the Muslim societies from within the Islamic framework. I'm making these assertions to set the tone of the urgency of this crisis. I will start with a brief summary of the context, further outlining the problem and solution. Next, I will present some scenarios to help analyze the prevailing attitude and practices concerning Muslim women and the study of Islam. By way of conclusion, I will answer the question in the title of my lecture, Why Muslim Women Must Reinterpret the Quran. I will answer the question with another question. That is there a hope that Muslim women's interpretation of the Quran will help? The fast answer to this latter question, no, not in the short run. And I'll explain why later. That is, the problem is not with Islam, but with the representation of Islam. Muslim societies themselves have not awakened to the reality that a human development is a process that is based on balancing a belief system with its interpretation, and not only on dogmatic value system. Non-Muslims, however, who are trying to help, do not realize that they are adding to the problem, because they often separate knowledge from the value system, ending up with further conflict. Let me give you the summary for those of you who might have to leave early or cannot listen to the end. As an educator concerned with the foundations of Arabic and Islamic studies, I can fairly suggest that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, would be amazed at the current Muslims' perceptions and practice of Islam. Most Muslims believe that by imitating the image and reported actions of the Prophet of Islam, that they have mastered their religious duties. Muslims came to codify these reported actions and view them erroneously as if they were as sacred as the Quran, to the point of missing the basic message that the Prophet had carried for 22 years between 610 and 632 AD. The Prophet, as an agent of change, was willing to take a risk by challenging the common knowledge of the time, yet the majority of today's Muslims are not willing to abandon the centuries-old representations of Islam that are misleading and unjust. They cannot think willing to abandon these misunderstandings in order to replace them with the egalitarian intention of Islam as outlined in the primary and the only divine source of Islam, the Quran. Let us remember that the Quran was the only written source during the life of Prophet Muhammad and for more than 100 years after his death, and before his biographies and the traditions were written. Referred to as Sunnah or Hadith as the second source of Islam, these traditions, essential as they may be, some of which were abused by male interpreters, like what is happening with regard to attire and seclusion. By using one single tradition to emphasize the extreme seclusion of women behind the head cover, that is erroneously called hijab, Muslims are ignoring basic teaching of the Quran concerning modesty that does not necessarily require the head cover or covering the hair. Quranic verses 26 to 60 in chapter 24 clearly intended to show measures of modesty in clothing and behavior for both males and females. The head cover, however, was practiced before Islam and continued to be practiced by Muslims for cultural or environmental reasons. More specifically, verse 31 of chapter 24 that talks about the khimar, meaning a shawl that's thrown over the head, talks about that cover to be brought over to cover the bosoms in order to protect protect lineage and inheritance, not to cover the head per se. The word hijab, meaning curtain, was imported from another chapter of the Quran, but abused when unjustly used for women's clothing to seclude all women instead of the intended respect of the privacy of the Prophet's household. It is therefore fair to claim that the message or the true message of Islam concerning women has rarely been practiced for the past 14 centuries because most representations of Islam by males are based on the reported traditions without being corroborated with the Quran. This hijacking of authority by males resulted over the centuries in segregating men and women, secluding women in the name of modesty that sometimes prevented them from educational institutions, discouraging and preventing women from congregational prayers and communal activities, often preventing them from conducting their own business, stripping women of their right to grant citizenship to their husbands and children, and above all, denying them direct identification with the Quran, that is, interpreting it on their own. Let me repeat, the above are only some of the evidence to support my affirmation that the true message of Islam concerning women has rarely been practiced for the past 14 centuries. Furthermore, it is also fair to state that as long as Islam is studied with the tools of Orientalism, that is, treating Islam as an object of study stamped with an otherness, the West will never be able to understand Islam nor help a Muslim woman. This is so because, in part, the West does not see these women as citizens in their own midst, nor realize that such women are already an integral element in the New West. Orientalists assume that Islam is an Eastern religion, like Buddhism or Hinduism, vis-a-vis the Judeo-Christian religion. They also assume that Islam needs to be interpreted by outsiders for the Muslims themselves. They tell the Muslims what they should know about their own religion. These assumptions do not apply to understanding Muslim women either, because Muslim women need to study themselves by themselves and for their own emancipation. Only by producing a new interpretation of the Quran would Muslim women be able to emancipate and help transform their communities and the Muslim majority societies, including those in North Africa and the Middle East. That is, there will never be a transformation movement or a reformation movement in Muslim societies like what happened in Europe, because the structure of Muslim societies and their aspirations are different. The social structure is built on the extended family social collaboration model, not on the nucleus economic model. While the aspirations are mostly related to past history and religious authority, morality, not to nationalistic or ethnic morality. So, neither sociological theories nor political science or legal analysis can fully explain the current crisis in understanding Islam or the core problem that Muslim women face, namely their absence from shaping and developing Islamic thought. Since reformation means retrofitting an old structure with some new elements that are external to the original scheme, and since most past reform movements have failed, the time has come for a revolutionary move to build a new structure for Muslim societies through an egalitarian interpretation of the Quran. This egalitarian interpretation must restore the religious, moral, rational authority to each individual Muslim by using two basic Quranic principles: observing the natural order of the world and developing actions plan by means of education, reason, and mutual consultation. Observing the natural order of the world and developing an action plan by means of educated reason and mutual consultation. These are the two basic principles of building a Muslim society. Let me bring some scenarios with the relevant attitude to explain some of the summary that I just presented. Although there are extreme cases of abuse and violence against women all over the world, including in the United States, let us look at two everyday concrete scenarios. Imagine a girls' school dorm on fire, and the firemen arrived on the scene but were refused by authorities to enter the building and rescue the girls, because it was believed that the girls will be exposed to unrelated men. The result was that many girls died. Imagine another incident where a 3-month pregnant woman developed a medical condition that requires aborting the fetus, but she refuses because she was told that it is forbidden on religious grounds. What should the doctor's guidance be in determining the next action? These scenarios may happen with some members of any religious group, but my concern here is not with the concrete example per se, as much as with the perceptual and attitudinal stance that surrounds these examples when they are related to a Muslim woman. The majority of Muslim women may also experience these scenarios and often have no clear explanations as well, mainly because their knowledge of Islam relies on secondary, conflicting sources instead of relying on the Quran. Muslim women may recite the Quran daily, many times, but they have been mostly absent from extracting meanings directly from it by themselves and for themselves. In other words, they have been absent from the decision-making process in which representations of Islam have been developed largely by Muslim males and sometimes by non-Muslims. For example, I was recently asked to review a legal memorandum on divorce in Islam that was written by a graduate student in an American law school. The student was volunteering in a clinic for women and justice that is supposed to help developing judges in developing countries, including Muslim countries, on gender issues. The memorandum began with the definition of quote-unquote Islamic law as synonymous with quote-unquote Islamic Sharia. I am perplexed. How could such an understanding produce justice for women when one of the most fundamental issues related to Muslim woman life is determined by someone who does not know the difference between Sharia and what is known in the West as Islamic law? Obviously, the student was following what has been taught in the American universities for decades without being questioned. Some of you may recall a recent lecture at the Commonwealth Club by Dr. Ali Karamali, who is present here today, thank you, who also addressed how the media confuses these terms. Let me further explain the magnitude of the problem for my purpose here. Sharia in Islam is the path or the guidance of the Quran, and it is only mentioned in one verse of the Quran. It is not the collection of rules derived by jurists or interpreters that were solidified by Western colonials under the title Islamic law. So Sharia is not Islamic law. This is very important. The Quran states in chapter 45, then we put thee on Sharia, or the path. So follow that way and follow not the desires of those who know not. Therefore, we need to critically examine the commonly used meanings of Islam, whether by Muslims or non-Muslims. Islam is neither a law nor a dogma of submission, as Muslims generally believe. Rather, Islam is a religious, moral, rational guidance. The view of Islam as a law was also influenced by the missionary emphasis on elite male leadership that supported the process of codifying customary practices under Islamic law, which often resulted in unjust practices and more conflict, such as when the United States interfered in drafting the Iraqi constitution that allowed for extremist Muslim clerics to slip in quote-unquote Muslim rulings as the basis for developing any law. Such rulings are those that have helped harming women in the past. The Archbishop of Canterbury's statement in February 2008 is another excellent example of well-intended gesture, but that represents misunderstanding the difference between the Islamic guiding principles of the Quran and what is known as Islamic law. His statement represents a gross miscalculation of its consequences when he suggested to the British lawmakers that they should come to, quote, accommodation with some aspect of Muslim law as we already do with aspects of other kinds of religious law, end of quote. It is a miscalculation because the present legal systems that some Muslims want to implant in the West consist of predominantly centuries-old interpretations and customary practices by Muslim males that were made into law with the support of colonial common laws to subdue the conservative Muslim male leaders of the time. The Archbishop's statement is not different from what had happened during colonial times. And it is also representing a dire implications of such a move, not only for England, but for Muslims and non-Muslims around the globe. Has the Archbishop forgotten the hardship that women have been suffering since similar rulings were imposed on Muslims and other religious groups by the British and other colonial during the 19th and 20th centuries? Therefore, the search for understanding Muslim women should be similar to the search for understanding history. It can never be completely secularized or viewed separately from the belief system it represents. It is next to impossible for a non-Muslim mind to comprehend any Muslim phenomenon without trying to find a representation on his or her own belief system, even when she uses a non-religious model. Likewise, it will be next to impossible for a Muslim male to explain issues related to Muslim women without retrieving past representations developed by male scholars. Hence, Muslim women read to reinterpret the Quran with their own frame of reference that does not propagate old interpretations. So is there a hope that Muslim women's interpretation of the Quran will help? Let me elaborate on why my answer was no, not in the short run. I first warned about the women's peaceful revolution almost 25 years ago in my 1986 article on gender justice in Islam, mainly to present evidence that Friday prayer is as obligatory for women because it is intended to discuss community affairs. So women being excluded from Friday prayer meaning excluded from community, discussing community affairs. But this pathetic condition for the majority of the 700 million Muslim women continue to deteriorate despite that some of them start flocking the mosques. Thus, I began conducting longitudinal social research with selected leaders of Muslim women grassroots groups. Meanwhile, I also resumed my own search for a foundational change through studying the Quran in order to develop different action plan. I concluded then that it was not enough to solve some social issues that are not necessarily specific to Muslim women, such as literacy, education, or violence. Rather, the situation required a change in perception and attitude on the ground. So I made my second wake-up call in my book, Women's Identity and the Quran, introducing my new reading of the text and the findings of my collaborative research with action-oriented Muslim women leaders who were also interpreting the Quran on their own. By focusing on a woman's identity and identifications with the Quran, I wanted to bring home the missing fundamental aspect in understanding Muslim women, namely their own intimate reading of the primary text of the Quran. I will read you just a small paragraph of what I read in the book. The lack of Muslim women's self-identity and identification with the Quran as the source for her own autonomous, spiritual, and intellectual existence proves that such a role contradicts the Islamic principles of justice, human trusteeship, and equilibrium. Thus, their intimate reading of the Quran was missing and continues to be missed by even some female exegesis and leaders. For example, in 2006, the first Muslim female president of the Islamic Society of North America, the largest Muslim organization, did not lead the co-educational congregational prayer with the excuse that the prophetic tradition disallows such a practice. This is more perplexing for me, because there is no such a narrative that prevents women from leading a co-educational congregational prayer. And even if there was such a narrative from the Prophet, peace be upon him, let us not forget that the Prophet may have been acting in the social context of the time. I have discussed in my book such contradictory statements and practices resulting from unjust interpretations of the Quran that are disguised in the name of Islamic law or even Islamic Sharia. How these interpretations have eroded Muslim women's autonomy. For example, male jurist interpretation of the two most controversial verses in chapter 4, verse 34 and chapter 2 are used to earmark for women's superiority and guardianship over women. In my book, I explain how such interpretations resulted in many harmful consequences. I will state only two. The first is that the woman lost her identification and self-identity and moral autonomy with Islam. That is, she is perceived and perceives herself as having a dependent or secondary complementary role in the social structure, whether within the family or the society at large. Instead, the Quran sees her as a principal in that structure. The first verse in chapter titled An-Nisa, meaning the woman, assert, O humankind, reverence your guardian God who created you from a single soul, created of like nature, her mate. So the female is the principal in the social structure. The second consequence, Muslims have lost the ability to directly relate the message of the Quran to its principle of keeping Quranic interpretations open in time and place, wherein each individual is responsible, have a moral responsibility to do that. The first verse that was revealed to Prophet Muhammad says, Iqra, meaning read. Read in the name of God who created a human out of clot. In other words, most Muslim interpreters changed Islam from being the religious moral rational worldview that gives each individual the moral autonomy and authority of understanding Quranic guidance directly in order to practice it fully into an authoritarian religion that is dominated by few male elites, like what had happened to Christianity when it became mostly constrained by the authority of the church. Since Islam, like all monotheistic religions, is intended to instill justice, it is not possible to achieve this Islamic state of mind, nor is it possible to fully practice the message of the Quran without each individual changing what is in his and herself. Also, being the principal nurturer of the next generation, the fact that women have been reading the Quran only through the many layers of biased interpretations means that complete Islamic social justice was never fulfilled, nor will the Islamic identity be fully affirmed among the younger generation. As the conditions during the last decade of the 20th century were favorable for me and for the majority of Muslim women scholar activists, we began to challenge this hijacked Islamic authority by Muslim men and began moving toward accomplishing comprehensive human rights for ourselves, including some of the elements of the CEDAW document. That is the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. Yet the drastic changes in the global politics landscape, political landscape since 2001, reversed these conditions and required our scholarship activism to move from the essential step of reinterpretation into more radical steps in order to apply the social justice contract between Muslims and Islam. By declaring ourselves an independent authority in Quranic sciences, we were and still are hoping that these transformative solutions will bring a meaningful reform for Muslim societies, meaning building a new structure based on reasserting Islam as a religious, moral, rational view intended for egalitarian justice. To conclude, let me explain again why I do not see a hope that women's interpretation of the Quran will change things in the short run. First, current Muslim women's discussion of gender and women's issues cannot be considered a social movement, nor an Islamic feminist movement. It is not a social movement because it is still at its infancy, limited to few scholar activists who are scattered geographically and linguistically or disjointed by nationalistic, sectarian, or ethnic disagreement. Also, an intimate reading of the Quran is not only to change the social structure, nor to solve women's issues, but mainly to change attitudes and perceptions about Islam. It takes a long time to re-educate and to establish higher Islamic learning or deeper knowledge of the Quran, as I suggest in my book. Muslim women's interpretation of the Quran may not be considered an Islamic feminist movement either, because the two terms contradict each other philosophically and in their knowledge base. Feminism is a creative theory intended to regain women's right and place in society by mainly analyzing the social construct of gender as a unit of analysis. Islam, on the other hand, is a universal worldview that propagates a single pair, the human pair, with equal rights and responsibilities, spiritually, intellectually, and socially. The unit of analysis for Quranic interpretation is what the Quran means by taqwa or reverence, i.e., the capacity, Taqwa means the capacity of each individual to balance all these roles in a specific time and at a specific place with the guidelines of the Quran. Yet the majority, Yet the majority of Muslims do not consider or practice the values of self-identity and self-governance as part of Islamic ethos. Second, we need to see Islam as a distinct three-legged process of A, deconstructing the habitual idea of acceptance and transposition of social customs from one location to another. B, making a connection between the message of Islam and the human interpretation of its nature. And C, reassessing the message on the basis of the needs on the ground while preserving the principles of the message. That is, we need to question the taking for granted interpretations that are based on certain local customs to identify with the Quran message or self-reflect in order to understand Islam beyond the rituals, and to rethink the message of Islam that there is no God but God in the same prophetic spirit of tolerating people's needs and time in time and place. Most contemporary Muslim scholars and organizations are not attending to any of these processes. Hence, the struggle will be difficult, long, and uncertain. Third and last, the majority of unjust misinterpretations is happening because of reliance on biographies, traditions, and juristic rules instead of realizing the Quran, its own principles of interpretation, as stated in chapter 39. Muslims are also becoming more conservative in response to challenges from within and from without. From within, religious and government authorities are collaborating because they feel threatened by the new interpretations. They feel threatened despite the fact that so-called Muslim progressive organizations are still weak in structure, vision, and strategies. In addition, Muslim scholar activist isolation is coupled with ignorant public who succumb to dictatorship and or brainwashing. From without, ideas of reformation modeled after European enlightenment or the American concept of democracy are creating further dichotomy because between religious and civil affairs, causing populist unrest directed toward outsiders instead of self-reflecting and focusing on eliminating dictatorship and dogmatism. To further complicate matters, Western governments are themselves supporting dictatorships in order to protect their own interests, producing further reactionary responses by religious extremists. Hence, I repeat, the struggle will be difficult, long, and uncertain, but it must begin somewhere. And thank you for listening.
Many thanks to Dr. Namat Hafez Barzanji. We got a lot of questions after your talk. First, I just want to give a little radio reminder that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker today is Dr. Namat Hafez Barzanji, discussing why Muslim women must reinterpret the Quran. So let me start with a question here about interpretations of the Quran. If the Quran as a text is open to conflicting interpretation, as all language is, what is the mechanism within Islam to determine and enforce the peaceful and socially just interpretation?
The question is, what is the mechanism to guarantee a peaceful interpretation?
Yeah, and I just think that's the core of this question.
It is the community itself to guard its own affairs. But the community sometimes get carried on with the common knowledge or with some social customs. Thus, it is the duty of each individual who has some knowledge of Islam to stand up and speak. It is a very strong responsibility for each individual to speak up.
So there isn't actually some kind of, within the structure of Islam, there isn't some place where people generally go to talk about interpretations of the Quran?
There is the structure, as I stated in my presentation, the Quran itself stayed the conditions for how to interpret. So this is the first basic principle. But from a social perspective, the community and each individual is responsible to God that these principles are being followed.
You talked a lot about the way sometimes the West misinterprets what happens within the Islamic world. And somebody here asked about what recently happened in France and may happen in Spain, which would outlaw the wearing of the full face veil by Muslim women. And I wonder how you view that in the context of what you just said.
I look at this issue like many other issues within three basic principles. First, the woman is the only authority. She has a right to decide and choose what to wear. So I would ask each government or group, whether Muslim or non-Muslim, keep your hands off women's attire. But let me follow with the second principle. As I stated in my presentation, the head cover is not required in the Quran. Therefore, what some of the women are practicing now, whether in France, Belgium, and even in the Middle East or North Africa, of covering the veil, I would really ask those women to reread the Quran and think more deeper of what they are doing, because they are harming Islam more than they are serving their own religion. It is not required by the Quran. One very important indicator is that women are not allowed in the greater mosque, the great mosque in Mecca, with a head with their face covered. So that is the third principle.
How are your theories being received by Muslims in general, and particularly in the Middle East?
Well, I am told that my views are very radical. But I am also told by many groups of not only women, but some scholars, and that is evidence in the 20-plus reviews that have been written by academics and non-academics of my book, that it is time to speak to the core of the issues rather than keep dancing around them. The main issue is the woman has lost her self-identity with Islam. She was never part in the process of the interpreting the Islam and in designing these juristic rules that are governing Muslim societies today. So it is time that woman takes the reign and start that process again.
I knew this question was going to come. Somebody is asking, with your radical ideas about reinventing who women are in Islam, are you at all concerned for your safety?
Well, everybody is concerned for their safety. But I don't think about it beyond what when I talk about it right now, because my conscience is clear. And there are three basic principles of reinterpreting Islam. Is to be at peace with oneself, at peace with the people around me, and at peace with my God, whom I believe in. That's it.
I think somebody here was interested. There have been, since the 1970s, Muslim women's movements that have been and are reinterpreting the Quran. And I guess somebody was interested in your commenting on some of the other movements where people like you are trying to reinterpret the Quran.
Well, in the past, there has been some interpretations of the Quran, but mainly they were using the traditional method of following the biographies or the jurist rules of interpretations. What I was talking about when I talked about the grassroots women groups now who are reinterpreting, they are going back again by using the basic principles that the Quran states of how to interpret the Quran, not following the traditional interpretations.
Somebody here asked, and it is a good question, what is the reason that women started wearing the veil in the first place? If it's a requirement that isn't actually in the Quran, where is a tradition like that coming from?
Well, I mean, you know that the veil or the head cover has been used since Byzantine time. Just go to the current exhibition in the De Jong Museum about the... I lost the word. The art of the 18th, 19th century. The Impressionist. Thank you. And you can see some of those pictures of women have veil on. So it has nothing to do with Islam. One of the reasons that became fixated on Islam is partially because the first thing, unfortunately, missionaries, including missionary nuns who themselves were veiled, when they went to the Muslim war, the first thing they said, we want to liberate these women by removing the head cover. And we see the example of First Lady Laura Bush when she said, we are going to Afghanistan to liberate Afghani women from the burqa. The burqa is the Afghani word for the totality of the attire of the woman. This is part of the problem where I am facing as a scholar of Islam, because not only I have to deal with the front of Muslims' misinterpretation and males' unwarranted authority, but I also need to deal with some of the fundamentalist, whether Christian, Jews, or any other religion, who are presenting ideas and trying to institute them within Islam. Very good example, what happens after 9/11, they start to institute the imamship. That is a person who's been volunteering to lead a congregational prayer. And the only two conditions for leading congregational prayer is that the person has to be knowledgeable of the Quran and of a just character. The government started institutionalizing this by presenting training and workshops and creating many things for that, that these Muslim, the present Muslim imams, who some of them don't even have good knowledge of Islam, to make them recognized leaders by the government. That is a mistake, a big mistake.
The struggles of women in Islam, you brought up just now, in fact, the West, nuns going, and historically in the West, women have also been oppressed within Christianity. What's happened over time is there's many different denominations. People can go to different churches, different places, and find a different interpretation of Christianity. Is there anything like that in Islam?
Well, there is no such a thing as denominations of Islam. Actually, the thrust of why Islam developed the civilization that it did for about 1,000 years is because it allowed differences in opinion. So we do not need to have one single interpretation to be followed. It is up to the individual conscience to be able to balance their understanding of the Quran with the social need of the time. That's one point. In terms of now institutional, as I said, they are institutionalizing imamship, which is wrong. It is a problem because those so-called imams may have one, they want to implement one sectarian interpretation of Islam. There are not many Islams as you've been hearing. It is wrong to say this Islam and that Islam. There is only one Islam, what is in the Quranic text. then there are many interpretations, and Islam allows for many interpretations in time and space.
Would you be able to teach, given your interpretations of the Quran, in Iran or Saudi Arabia and some of the countries that people in the West view as being the most strict?
Well, I will tell you, I used to teach in Saudi Arabia, maybe not recently, but actually my being in Saudi Arabia in the early 80s and the way I saw Islam being practiced is what triggered this work, because I resented that particular interpretation. But also, there are some islands of light within Saudi Arabia itself, and probably in Iran. I haven't been in Iran, so I cannot speak that, although I know many Iranian female scholars who are doing similar work. I will be happy to teach if I'm invited.
Many people have heard, I think, about, you know, centuries ago there was a kind of renaissance within Islam. People often talk about this sort of enlightened period within Islam. During that period, were women treated differently?
Yes, generally they were. But the only missing issue which I'm focusing on is they were never participant in the development of the juristic rulings that being practiced. And that's why I said they were never involved in the development of Islamic thought. And that's why we have this major crisis in understanding Islam.
Somebody asked, and you have talked about this a bit, but maybe you can elaborate even more. How can the attitudes of Muslim and Arab nations towards Islam be modified and revised? And how is the West contributing to the problem?
Well, again, let me correct the questioner. It is not Islam that will be modified. It is the interpretation that has to be changed, not only modified. As I stated, reformation does not work because... I'm sorry. When I get excited, my throat dries up. Again, Islam is not to be revised or modified. Islam stays the same as the text of the Quran has been for more than 14 centuries. What is to be changed and transformed is our understanding of the text and interpreting of the text.
I'm curious, in countries where the role of women is very prescribed, how do you even get to a point where women will be allowed to interpret the Quran?
Well, you can think of myself, even though I come originally from Syria, that's considered a very, quote-unquote, moderate country in terms of the practice of Islam and the society there. But still, I was never thought of to become a scholar of Islam because I was a woman. So that could happen. Now, talking about more stricter, the Quran reminds us that if you cannot act on something, then say it, talk about it in your tongue. If your tongue was cut, then think about it in your heart. So you have to do something about it, and we have to keep encouraging these women, as constricted as they may be. I happened to be in Pakistan on a special project for adult literacy in 1996. I couldn't believe the scene when I saw those women, illiterate women, adults, who were cramping in a room smaller than this area, about 20, 25 of them. trying to learn the Quran. Because even though they did not read and write, they were trying to learn about it by memory or by recitation. So if the will is there, things can move.
I'm curious if you think that in that aspect there's anything the West can or should do to encourage this.
Yes, definitely. Stop the wars. Because they are doing nothing but creating more extremists. You are harming Muslim women than you ever think of with these wars. The second thing is revise the assumptions that you have about these Muslim women. As I said, and even though I may have presented a very sad and pessimistic view, there are still some women who live day-to-day life trying to improve their lot in whatever means possible. And look of what happened to the well-known author of Three Cups of Tea. Some of you may be familiar with that book. To build about 300 schools for girls under these conditions in northwest Pakistan and northeast Afghanistan is not a simple task. He's done it because he believed in it. He did not need the help of government. He only accepted philanthropic donation from people like you and I.
We have time for one last question, and I'm wondering, this is a very good question. I'd be interested to know this. I don't read Arabic, so I would be really interested to know if there's an existing translation of the Quran that you can recommend that is free of just inherent bias.
Yes, the translation by Muhammad Dawood is the simplest, more direct language to speak into the Western mind.
So well, thank you. Thank you very much. Sure. We've been listening to Dr. Namat Hafez Barazanji, and I want to thank her for her comments. We also thank our audience here as well for listening. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is over, celebrating 100 years of enlightened discussion. We are adjourned.